Hello and welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a weekly podcast on the Django Web Framework. I'm Will Vincent, joined as always by Carlton Gibson. Hi, Carlton.
Hi, Will.
This week we have a very special guest, Kenneth Love. Hi, Kenneth.
Hi. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, we're thrilled to have you on. You're on the short list of people I wanted to have on the podcast when we were thinking about it way back when. So perhaps you could tell the folks out there who are you and why are you such a big name in the Django world?
I can definitely do the
Or I can do
part.
It for you if you want.
I'll give it a try and then you can fill in anything you think I missed. I'm Kenneth Fair Love. I've been involved in the Python and Django worlds for about a decade now, I guess, quite a while. I'm an open source contributor. I speak at conferences a lot, or did. I was chair of DjangoCon US for 2018, which was really fun. What else? Oh, I used to teach Python online. A lot of people watched that. And I've done some technical editing, namely Python Crash Course by Eric Mathes, which is an amazing book if you haven't read it. I got to read it a bunch of times.
A lot of people have. A lot of people have read that one. Let's start off with something. So I think I first came across you partly from Treehouse, but before that, you had done, I believe, Django Braces, right? And that has since been, I wonder if we could talk about that, because that has since been rolled into Django. So kind of what was that process of coming up with your own Django things and then rolling that in? I think that might be interesting for folks to understand how new features are rolled into Django itself.
Sure. Yeah. So quite a while ago, when class-based views first came into Django, so that was, I don't know, what, like 1.4? Something like that? I don't know. It was a long time ago. They honestly kind of sucked when they first came in. They were very difficult to use. It was a great idea. They were a wonderful game-changing idea, but they were just kind of hard to use, mainly because you had to go and recreate a lot of stuff yourself every time you used them. Even though they were class-based views, there wasn't a lot of really nice features for like using them like there were with the function-based views that have been around for, you know, 5-6 years by that time. So a lot of people really kind of hated class-based views. I gave a talk at DjangoCon about them because I thought they were awesome and nifty, and tried to get people excited about them. People seemed to like them. And around that same time, my friend Chris Jones and I were working as contractors. We were using a lot of class-based views, and we were finding a lot of the pain points. And so we just started writing mix-ins for the class-based views to make them easier for us to use in our job, like in our day-to-day work. And that's what became Django Braces. The name's a joke on a couple of different levels. It got really weird in meta, so like I don't even try to explain it anymore. But it's just called Braces. And so it's a whole bunch of mix-ins that make class-based views easier to use. So you can make it to where your view requires that the user is authenticated, that they're part of a certain group, that they're a super user, that they pass some arbitrary test. And then we got a bit further in making it to where like you could use class attributes to specify the fields used for a select related or a prefetch related. So just stuff like that to make class-based views just nicer to use, to where you don't have to write all that stuff yourself constantly.
Back in the day, this was one of my main packages. Whenever I started a Django project, it was install Django braces, there was another one I used called model utils, and these were like, you know, it was phenomenal. So I have to say thank you retrospectively. I used it very many times.
Well, so, and actually, I don't know this. I could look it up, but how were they brought into Django itself? Did you work on that, Kenneth, or did others bring the code in? Because I know login required mix-in. I mean, most of these are now part of Django itself.
Yeah, the ones that deal with authentication, so like the auth authentication required or login required, super user and group, I think, are all added in. And those are all built on top of a common class that's like, what is it? I think it's access mix-in.
That rings a bell.
Basically, it's the one that just controls access. We name things as obviously as we can. This was Django birthday, so that would have been 2015. Yeah, Django Birthday was like right when it happened. So around Django Birthday, Braces had gotten enough steam, or ClassBase views themselves had gotten enough steam that people were really invested in using them. And some, I cannot remember the name. I will put the commit into the show notes if I can find it.
Okay.
somebody was working on effectively Django Braces for Django as an actual patch to Django. And there was a lot of back and forth, like dev chatter. Oh man, you're going to see how bad my memory is for people's names. Mark something. He was, core committer, probably still is.
Mark Tamlin?
Anyway.
Tamlin?
Yeah, I think so.
He did the Postgres.
Contrib Postgres stuff later on.
I think it was him.
Okay.
I think it was him. I don't remember for certain. Anyway. I'm sorry. Whoever it was, I'm terribly sorry I forgot your name. Anyway, they reached out to me and Chris because we had written Django Braces and they went, hey, is this a good approach? And the code they had was fine. It was good. But there was a couple of race conditions in it to where... or not race conditions, but a couple of conditions in it to where you couldn't necessarily override things cleanly in like multiple steps or multiple places, mainly around like the access, or it's not access, the Django has a thing that's user passes test.
Yeah.
Which is,
I use that all the
it's
time.
Built into the old login required, and it's a class-based view or mix in now. Basically, the idea is you can pass a lambda to this thing, and if your user object passes that lambda, then the user's considered good. The way they built it, and you'll have to forgive me, this is four or five years ago, I don't remember what they wrote, but the way they wrote it made it to where it would prevent having like multiple checks on users passing tests, because the user can only pass one test at a time. Mm-hmm. The way they'd written it, you couldn't have multiple tests. So we were like, why don't you just use what we wrote in Django Braces? Like, it's BSD or MIT, it's open source, like you can just merge it in. Just take what you want, and that's basically what they did. Yeah. So that's how those three or four mix-ins got into Django. It was, I don't know. It was basically us just going, here, we did the work, take it, and then they took it.
But that's a great story because, like, very often a user will come to Django developers and they'll say, I've got an idea for a feature, and this happens on Django. It also happens on REST framework a lot. But it's like, people say, you've got an idea for a feature. It's like, well, great, can you put that in a third-party package? And then, you know, yeah, if that third-party package gets take-up, well, then we can look at bringing it into core. And the great thing about this is it gives you a playground in which to test it. And if there's bugs and issues, and they can get worked out and ironed up, and then we can really see, you know, is this useful? And that and then it can be brought in. So this happened with South, I guess, most sort of famously, the migrations framework, that became Django's migrations. I mean, you know, with a rewrite.
But. Yeah. Yeah, there's not... The underlying code, there's a huge difference between South and Django's migrations.
Yeah, right, but lessons were learned.
They got drastically improved. But the idea is exactly the same.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't do much that's special compared to South.
Yeah.
So I know these days you're working for O'Reilly, right, on their platform. And I saw, I think you tweeted about this a while back, that you had, one of the projects you'd done is new onboarding. I was curious, an important thing that isn't well served in tech in general. So I was curious kind of what you learned and where that was at, because I know of almost no cases where people say, oh yeah, my onboarding was a great experience.
Yeah. So I joined O'Reilly just about 2 years ago, and I feel like my onboarding was pretty typical for a lot of tech companies. you show up at the office we're a remote company, to a very large degree. So you show up at the office for like a week, and you know you're going to meet with your manager, and we have a thing called an onboarding buddy, or had. And the idea is, like, you know, say I'm getting hired, and Will, you're already established, maybe you're on the team that I'm going to be joining, you'd be my onboarding buddy. I'd spend a week basically, you know, connected at the hip to you.
Right.
And we'd go to stand up and you'd show me around all the code, and you know, we'd work on a ticket or two together, and so then I'm like, I'm good to go, right? And I can join my own team or your team if that's the team I'm joining, whatever my thing is, and I'm ready. And that's okay. It works. Like, we've all been through something similar to that, and it works okay. But it's not great. Usually, you know, you end up spending 2 or 3 days with like HR and IT getting things set up. in my case, my buddy, and dude's great, like no shade towards him at all, but I arrived right when like a major fire broke out on the platform, and he spent 4 out of the 5 days fighting that, because it was in a section that he was working on. And so while I figured out what was where at O'Reilly and got everything sorted, it wasn't the illuminating educational week that I think everyone had hoped for. So a month or two later, 6 months later, I don't know, a while later, speaking to my manager, and I was like, you know, our onboarding is kind of messy. I mean, like, so the onboarding buddy thing, that's a really great idea, but that buddy ends up spending half or more of their time working with the new hire instead of doing sprint work, which they were calculated to do a certain amount of sprint work. And often you as a new hire are on a team that you're not actually going to be part of. So you spend a lot of time kind of sort of trying to fit in, but you know you're only going to be talking to that team for a week or two. So you're not able to make like a good like friendships or really get to know a particular person or whatever. You'll still work with them even if you're not on the team, but it's not, you know, that closeness. So my idea was like, well, why don't we have a team where all the new hires go to, and they all all live on this team. We're not taking time away from existing sprint work. And while they're on that team, they're doing tickets from the backlogs of all the other teams. The stuff that the team wants to do, but never is like never finds time to do, right? The little cleanup stuff, the improving test coverage stuff, make the deploy process better, just whatever.
Yeah, but those little tasks, they're really important, because you've got to, you want to be actually touch the code base, but without really touching it, you know?
Right. Yeah. I can go fix docs all day long. Yeah. I can improve code test coverage all day long without worrying that I'm going to break something. Yeah. But it still shows me the code base, and it teaches me how does project A touch project B, and both of them feed into project C somehow, right?
Yeah.
Now I get a bigger idea of that picture.
Yeah, and you still have to get your development environment running and all of those things, which...
Right.
Yeah.
And not only do you have to get your development environment running, and at this time we were still somewhat messy on that, you have to get multiple development environments running, because you have to have each project set up, right? We're doing microservices, you've got
permissions to
projects that run. You've got to get permissions, you've got to get, you know, everything talking to each other in Docker, like all of that. And often that's a big mess. You're going to be faster at it the more times you do it, and you're going to get to do it a whole lot while you're on the onboarding team, because that's all you're doing is working on other random projects. And you have to go talk to those teams and deal with PRs and all that stuff, because you've got to make PRs to all of their projects. And it's worked out as like a really great way for a new engineer to come into O'Reilly. They're not pressured on time. They're not pressured on points. There's no like velocity tracking. There's nothing like that. It's just, here's a bunch of tickets. Find one that you find interesting, and I or someone else will help you get in touch with the right people. We'll review the PRs. We'll try to help you get it merged and deployed. Whatever we have to do, we'll work on all of that with you as someone who's dedicated just for onboarding. You're not taking me away from other work. I've got nothing to do but help you. And it's worked out really well. We've had 20-ish people go through it. We really only use it when we have like a lot of hires. If it's like we hired one person in the last 3 months, we don't really bother with it. But if we've got 5 new hires coming in, then we spin the team back up and do onboarding for a month or so.
That sounds really good. That sounds, you know.
Yeah.
That stuff's really important. I mean, I'm remembering when I was at Quizlet, our goal was to have the first day someone was there, they committed code. So that was sort of like a good litmus test. So like I had a routine because we were hiring at the time, and I would swing by before work the Apple store, get my corporate account, get the laptop, run all these commands, get them set up, poke someone on the shoulder to get permissions. And even that was sort of the goal. And it just really helps with, we always thought it was, you only have someone feel comfortable they're going to be there for the first three months. So you're still kind of selling them. I mean, this is San Francisco. Okay. This is a number of years back. But so the idea was, you know, you can't just take them for granted just because they're there and plop them down. Like, you know, just as small as it sounds, like coming in and being like, what did I do today? Like, oh, I committed a little bit of code. And this is all pre-Docker too. So a lot harder to do that. But yeah, that sounds great. Yeah, it's an important thing. And that's also the cultural stuff, right? It's just like your first reference point. You're so wide-eyed and impressionable about the organization you're going to work on.
Yeah. And I mean, I didn't do this part at all, but HR interviewed everyone that went through the program, the onboarding afterwards, and asked them, like, you know, how was it? Was it positive? Was it negative? Did it make you feel more comfortable? Whatever. And like, everyone so far has been really positive about it. They've enjoyed their time that they spent on the onboarding team. They've often said they haven't had an onboarding like that anywhere else, which
it's probably true.
I believe, because I haven't heard of many people doing that. But they also said that they ended up being much more comfortable when they got on their final team.
Mm-hmm.
They felt like they were already good with like how our whole system works together. And they kind of knew like, okay, if I have a question about this aspect, I go to this Slack channel and ask, or I ping this one person. And they weren't, you know, you lose that shyness you have at the beginning of a new job. You lose that awkwardness that's there.
Right.
Simply because you've already talked to all these people. You've already met a bunch of these people.
Yeah, you've been there a month.
Yeah. And you've been there a month without having to do anything that's like super stressful. And if it's not a one size fits all. We don't say like everybody stays there for a month or 2 weeks or whatever. It's when you feel like you're ready to go. Cool. You can go join your team and we're good. So yeah, everybody kind of has their own time on that too. We let people be comfortable.
That sounds good. Can I ask, is the O'Reilly platform, is that largely built on Django, a bit built on Django, not built on Django at all?
Or
are you allowed to say?
It used to be called Safari.
Yeah.
So by the O'Reilly platform, just for anybody who's not familiar with it, because it's a little pricey. It's basically a way for you to come and you can read books from O'Reilly and a bunch of other publishers like Pearson and Manning and stuff like that. And then you can also watch conference videos from the O'Reilly conferences. And we do like some live online training, stuff like that. So that is built. I don't have an exact number for you, like exact percentages, but it's 75% or better Python and Django.
Cool.
Obviously, there's a lot of like SQL. We have some stuff that's in Ruby, some stuff that's in Go, but
anything big,
almost everything you touch. Yeah, almost everything you touch is Python. Python and JavaScript.
Yeah.
Can I ask what version of Python you're on?
Almost everything is on 3.7.
Yay.
Oh, wow. Good for you all.
We do still have a couple of things that are on 2.7.
Right. Well, just because we just did an interview with actually the folks at edX, just speaking of the education platforms and more generally here at Django Boston, there are some talks on migrating from 2 to 3 because 2020 is approaching and
got about 3 months.
There's going to be, I think January and February, there's going to be a lot of renewed interest in this.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of panic. We have a really handy tool that we built internally. We call it the chassis that is kind of like cookie cutter on steroids. Basically, you can run a start command and tell it what kind of project you have. It's a Django project, a JavaScript project, or, you know, whatever. And it will set up all of your Docker stuff for you. It will set up all your Kubernetes stuff for you. It will install dependent, like it'll do basically everything.
Wow.
And so because of that, we can push out like, hey, everybody, the chassis now has the newest version of Django and Python 3.7 point whatever, right? And all that the engineers have to do, one of them per project, they go in, they basically run a Docker compose build pull to pull down the newest version of the chassis image. They run like a regen, which regenerates their Docker compose files and Kubernetes files if it needs to be, and they deploy, and that's it. And now they're on the newest version. So like it's 10 minutes from us putting out a new version of the chassis to literally every team being
right,
up to date.
But assuming their application code is compatible, right? There's that one little lemma there.
Well, yeah, they have to run tests and all that stuff, but most of our apps are stock Django and Django REST framework kind of stuff. They're not super complex or fragile. So most of the time it gets by just fine. We've actually had more things fail with PyTest upgrades than we have Django upgrades.
Yeah. I mean,
there you go. Well done, Carlton.
Well, no, but PyTest have been quite aggressive in breaking stuff. So all for the progress, but
yeah.
You know.
No, Yeah, no shade toward them at all. But, like, you will get a point release of PyTest that has, like, 8 new features and suddenly a fixture doesn't work anymore. And good luck finding that one in, you know, less than a couple of
minutes. But, like, we've had builds on, say, Django Crispy Form. Django Crispy Forms is mature as you want and stable. And, there'll be a new release before 3.0. And, you know, it's just ticking away. And there's, like, one release per major version of Django. And like, all of a sudden, the PR will come in and it's broken. Why? PyTest upgraded. Okay, all right, let's fix that. So.
I love PyTest, but. Sometimes those updates.
But that's super. I was going to say on the Django thing, if you haven't gone right down into custom modern fields and using internal APIs that aren't really documented, that upgrade process now is just, you know, there's no reason not to keep up, as I say, every week on this.
Yeah.
Yes, Carlton and I internally channel David Hennemeyer Hansen came on recently, and we talked about this at length, you know, in the Rails world and the Django world, and he... What was his saying, Carlton?
Upgrade your FNS.
So in our head, we're always thinking about that.
You should upgrade. You should always upgrade.
So I also wanted to ask. So O'Reilly's a teaching platform, and you had spent I think a couple of years at Treehouse and maybe some other areas. So I'm wondering, what was it like? What's it like for you going from, you know, teaching full time to engineering? Is that something? Because obviously, I think about this. Is that something that you see as a back and forth, or what are your thoughts on that? Because that's the challenge with teaching this stuff: is it changes all the time. It's not math. So, you know, every time you spend teaching, in a way, you're kind of getting stale and rusty on not working on bleeding edge stuff.
Yeah, it was definitely not necessarily weird, but I felt very new. Going back to being an engineer. I spent about 3.5 years at Treehouse, and I spent about a half a year doing corporate training before that.
Okay.
So I had about 4 years of not really writing code other than you've written several books. You know how it is when you write code, but it's illustrative code, right? It's some small project.
Right. It feels like toy apps for forever, and everything is clean because you control everything, and there's nothing...
Right.
It feels like it's not real.
Nothing to worry about.
Yeah, it doesn't feel real.
Yeah. Yeah, no matter how complete the thing you build is, it always feels not real because you conceived of the entire thing from beginning to end, and you built the entire thing from beginning to end in a process that's replicable, and it's, like, gonna work.
Right, a teaching first idea with the code, yeah.
Yeah, so going back to dev where it's messy and, and real, I felt very new. To engineering. Yeah. I could obviously read and write the code, no problem, but, like, dealing with the scope of things was often a little strange.
But it's also nice in a way that you can also just focus on one area and go deep because you have to because it's blocking something. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, you know, I feel like I miss having to go deep on stuff because I have to maintain all these other things. And, you know, so it's all trade-offs, but these are some of these trade-offs I hadn't anticipated, but you're further along on this journey than I am. So
yeah, it's also been strange because, like, being back at O'Reilly, being back as an engineer, I'm obviously doing more engineering, but being, you know, older and ideally wiser, but having done this for so long, I'm starting to find, like, the things that I like to do, the things I don't like to do. You know, if I have my choice between teaching and programming, I'm going to choose teaching every single time. But as an engineer, that's not a question I really get.
Mm.
So that's led to, like, the onboarding group to, you know, considering going into management, trying to do other things to scratch that teaching itch. But yeah, it's made it to where, like, going back into the engineering is great. I've enjoyed writing code again, but I've come to realize it's not the thing I want to do all the time.
Right.
Which is a weird thing for a lot of younger programmers, because you kind of get taught that, like, well, you should be eating and sleeping and breathing code, like, all day long. Surely you have 18 side projects going on, and, you know, what do you mean you're dating someone? How do you have time for dating? You should be writing code. Like,
you can date a programmer, right?
Yeah. Well, we'll link in the show notes. Carlton, actually, Carlton and I first connected because he gave a talk, I think, just last year at DjangoCon Europe.
The year before. It was in Heidelberg.
2017?
2017.
Okay. Anyways, on being, you know, a programmer of a certain age. And well, and I think of that in the context, I'm curious what you both think, in that there's this idea that in any area of expertise, somewhere around 5 years plus or minus, you haven't gotten your 10,000 hours, but the newness has worn off. You kind of understand how hard things are to do, and you sort of need to redefine why you're doing it, find new reasons to do it. I see that a lot with programmers too. I mean, and I'm probably in that boat a little bit too. You know, if I was going to write just code 8 hours a day, I don't know. You know, it's not quite, when I was starting out, that was fantastic. Do more and more. But now, I don't know if it's interested in deeper questions or I see the limits of my own ability. But, you know, I think it's extremely common, and just people don't really talk about it. But, you know, if 5, 10, 15 years in, I think the things you're interested in have to and do change. And it's not for everyone just to have pure code, in part because if you work in organizations, you see that code is often not where the problem is. It's management, it's onboarding, it's all these soft things, but you have to be...
Even from an engineering point of view, it's not just code. It's about the design of the software that you're building, and it's about it making sure that it meets the actual needs that really are, rather than something you came up with in your head. And like a junior, brilliant, stick them at the keyboard, get them banging it out. But more experienced engineers are there in meetings designing the software and coming up with how it's going to work. And that's just as much of the software crafting process as actually, you know, opening up the editor and writing some code.
Well, I think it's the burden of knowledge in a way, because when you're starting out or you're newer, you just fix what's in front of you and you don't even know about these larger concerns where, you know, that's why I love, you know, I'm sure you've had this, you know, with beginners, they'll email me or talk to me and say, oh, I want to build this thing. And they'll just list all these things. And in my head, I'm just calculating how painful it's going to be, all these third-party APIs, and they're so excited. But like, that's great. Like, I've got scar tissue around it, right? So I have to balance my knowledge with like, well, maybe it's doable, maybe it's exciting, instead of thinking about, oh God, like how hard it's going to be. And that's a little bit, mm-hmm. I think, at least I'm kind of at that point where I'm like, yeah, I could do basically anything, but I kind of know how hard a lot of that is. And so it makes it maybe a little bit less exciting than it would be if I didn't know more of how the sausage is made.
Yeah, it's been an interesting thing. I have a couple of fairly junior programmers that I mentor just completely like outside of work, just divorced from anything. And with one of them especially, the idea of like, you need to sit down and plan your software before you start building it is like this horrible thorn in their side and this thing that they just cannot deal with doing. And like, they'll do it obviously because, you know, like, it's a good idea. You're supposed to do it. And I, you know, I'm helping them and walking them through and stuff. But like, that idea didn't really enter their mind, right? Like, they gave themselves like a bullet list and then that was kind of it. And it's like, well, that's cool. That's great for like your script, like your first rough pass-through version. But when you want to build something that's like, you know, a SaaS product or some other kind of like thing actually being used by humans for money, you generally have to go a little further than a bullet list. And so like sitting down with them and thinking through like, okay, how is this part going to work? How can I get from A to B and still get the thing I want done? I feel like it was fairly eye-opening for them. And I mean, and for me as well with the, like you're saying, like the junior programmers they don't know how the sausage is made. They're just excited to build something. They just want to make something.
Yeah. They're like driving a car at night with head beams and, you know, yeah, it's exciting. Stay on the road. But I wonder how much of that is it an attitude shift or is it just a knowledge thing where it doesn't even occur to them to ask these questions?
What could possibly go wrong? What could possibly go wrong? I'm just writing software.
It's the ignorance
of
youth.
Puzzles. Yeah. I'm good at logic puzzles. Yeah. What could possibly go wrong? Oh my, as you fall off the cliff.
Right. Well, and then, yeah. Right?
And like everybody who's been doing it a while has been on these projects, which have just exploded. But they didn't know that before. They were like, yeah, we're going to build this thing and it's going to be amazing.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh my word.
Yeah. You get better at seeing the cliffs
everybody.
The longer you've been doing it. Like in the beginning,
right,
everything's foggy. There's no cliffs. There's never been a cliff. What's a cliff? And then you do it for 5-10 years and you're like, oh my God, we are going to die on any step we take.
Right.
How do
right.
we not?
Right. Why?
Then you just sit in silence, like a sort of, you know, enlightened lotus position. Yeah, why aren't you programming? Yeah, you'll find out.
Because I'm thinking. What are you thinking about? The horrible things.
Well, I mean, you have a newsletter, which we'll link to.
That I have one episode of a news, or one issue of a newsletter.
You know what? It's a...
Everyone's got that.
Right. Well, I watch Carlton's talk, right? He blogs once a year kind of thing. It's the same thing for me.
Yeah. Exactly.
Way to sell that newsletter.
Under promise, over deliver, right?
It's a good issue when it comes, you know.
Yeah. Well, I was gonna say, though, I feel like in many ways I'm the inverse of most developers, and yourself included, where I started off not in tech, and then I was in business, and then I was in management, and I'm sliding backwards into, you know, developer on teams, and now solo developer. So I find this, it's interesting to me that you think management might sound interesting. Let me just say that. But I think that's because I have all the scar tissue from it, where I see the need, then I just go, you know, sometimes I'm fighting with code, and I'm like, well, at least it's not
at least it's not people.
At least it's all my yeah. Well, you know, I mean, all of us have kids. You know, I have kids. It's like I don't need more work kids to deal with.
Sure.
You know, you need parents, but and I guess so. It's like anything, right? Like when you have experience doing it, you realize how important it is, but also how much work it is to do. Mm-hmm. And it's and I would say, you know, and probably this is the teacher in me, which you can relate to. I mean, managing someone and a group to get somewhere is more rewarding than doing it myself, but it is harder.
Yeah.
Right. Like you can't control people as well as you can control code. Like that's, as I get older, I'm like, well, code kind of works. Like there is an answer out there, but these real questions are just like, who knows? Like,
yeah.
So I guess I'm just speaking out loud, but I'm encouraged that you're going the opposite track as I've gone. Cause I'm like, what are you doing?
Yeah. I mean, it's, I've been reading, as I'm getting more interested in management, and actually yesterday it was official, I've been promoted to a dev lead, team lead
nice.
Thing.
Congrats.
I've had like four different names for what this title is, so I don't even know how to describe it. Basically,
Promotion's a promotion.
I'm in charge of the care and feeding of a group of developers, but I'm not their manager, which is important.
Well played.
Anyway,
well played.
As I move into this and I read more about it, investigate more into it, yeah, there really is this kind of dichotomy kind of thing where it's like you have the engineers that want to go into management, like myself, and then you have the engineers that are like, I would never be caught dead in management. And
right.
I know a lot of those. Like, there's tons of those people.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know why it's like, oh, I want to do management. I think it's just that it's much closer to my ideal of being this teachery kind of thing, but still working in like corporate America. Cause I can't get a position as just like, you're going to teach stuff to people we've hired. I know it exists.
Well, assuming that's the case. Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, just as we were saying about losing your skills when you're teaching, that's the problem with management is you go manage for, you know,
sure.
And then you have to manage and code. And then, you know, in 2 years, you have to go to another job and you're like, what are you going to hire me for? Engineering manager? Great. Okay. Pass all these coding tests. And you're like, well, I haven't actually coded much in the last 2 years. Like, yeah. But you still need to pass the test. So there is this like fear that like once you switch over, you can't go back.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's true because I think you forget how much you actually know. But that's definitely the problem is people become a manager, but then also have to do coding and then they're doing two jobs and then they get burned out. And I've had friends who were, I mean, God, I worked with them at Quizlet when they were in college and now they're like 27 and managers at Stripe and stuff. And they've already gone through this process of being promoted up to managers and then burning out and then going into a new company as an independent solo contributor for a year. And now they're in management again. But I almost think that maybe that's the natural way to do it is to have that flow because when they're managing, they're just working crazy hours. And when they're a developer, you know, they can work a lot less and get paid more and it feels better. So yeah. I don't know. It's not a static thing, I guess, even for people who I consider to be really good managers. And that's partly what makes them good managers is that they haven't spent 10 years, you know, running sprints. They're still doing the sausage themselves.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot to be said for the managers that have that recent relevant experience. And I think there's... I've been reading a book called The Manager's Path. Can't remember if it's Manager Path Manager's Path. By, I think it's Camille Fournier, something like that. It's a really, really good book. Awesome book. I've been reading it stupidly slowly. Because every once in a while I have time to read. But a really good book so far. And she talks about how... I think it was her. It may have been Charity Majors on Twitter. It's one of those two.
We can look it up.
Was talking about how, like, you shouldn't really be a manager for more than 2 years. And after 2 years, you should go back to being an independent contributor so that you keep your coding chops, right? You keep up to date with stuff.
Right.
I don't think that's a bad approach. I think that makes a lot of sense of having this, like, management's a thing you do for a few years and then you go back and then maybe you go back to management. That's cool because you're ideally still a good manager, but you're able to dip back in and get that relevant, real experience in your company. I think it also would help if we didn't do tech management like we do tech employment, which is badly. Because we have an industry that burns people out really, really fast and really, really hard. And those need to be fixed. We shouldn't be burning people out like that. It's honestly one of the things I love the best about O'Reilly. We have people that retire every year at like 30 years of being at O'Reilly. We have engineering managers and engineers that have been there for a decade or better. That's insane in modern tech companies, right? Like, what's the longest tenure at, you know, like Twitter? 5-6 years, other than, you know, CEO.
What's the vesting schedule?
Oh, well, yeah, it's probably whatever the vesting schedule is, right? So, because you hit that you hit that cliff, and then you're gonna go.
Well, in startup land, I think I heard is something like it's under 2 years the average.
I think for startups, it's like 18 months. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, but part of this is even I have a friend who works at a hospital on the business side, and part of it is it's companies don't promote internally. So he's worked at this same big place here in Boston for 10 years. He works 2 years, he leaves and does something else for a year and comes back, and that way he gets bumped up 15% every time. Otherwise, he'd be stuck at 2% a year. And same thing with startups, you know, it's, and I've managed people and been like, hey, we need to pay this person more. It's like, nope, don't have money for them, so we lose them. And then someone else comes in and we can jack that person up. It's like only when you're hired can you actually get paid what you're worth. And so aside from the culture, just the pay is a problem where most companies don't pay people what they're worth and undervalue how much it costs to lose someone and train someone. And you know, and for me personally, being a manager, managing sounds good, but hiring, I did that for 2 years at Quizlet. I don't want to do that again. That's so much work and so soul-sucking and not soul-sucking. It's just so much work to do. Mm-hmm. And then that I think when I think of manager, I think of hiring. And that's hard.
I have not had to do hiring yet. I obviously we've done interviewing things like that, but I haven't done hiring or firing. So I can imagine that that's pretty stressful and a lot to deal with. I can't say though at the moment. I'll come back once I've done some hiring and firing, and we'll talk about it then and find out what's up.
I also wanted to mention. For listeners, so both you and Carlton work out of a home office, though I think, Carlton, you're in your home and you're in a brand new place, which last time I spoke with you last fall was clean, and now you have accumulated stuff. But
I'm
it's like a dedicated shed?
There's things everywhere.
You have a dedicated place, though, right?
Yeah. When we bought our house, it had like a garage attached to it, and we never really used it. We park our one vehicle outside, and the garage was kind of just a junk collection area. And then I've got two kids and we only have three bedrooms and I was using one bedroom as an office. That's not enough rooms for people. So we converted about 3/4 of our garage into new living space. So we've got like a laundry area. My wife has an area for crafting, and then I have a dedicated, fairly soundproofed office. My plan is to use it for filming video courses myself, but that has not happened at all yet. So it's just my office. And yeah, it's kind of a mess right now. There's like, I got a poster on the wall, which I don't think you can see in the current video.
No, we can see.
There you go. There's a poster. there is a cutout of me on the wall for placement of a camera later. There's climbing gear, there's board games, there's keyboards, there's all just stuff. It's a mess. It's a giant mess.
Yeah. That's a family house.
I find it interesting how people get their best work done, and it varies for everyone. And I think also, again, when you've been doing it as long as all three of us have, you sort of find out what works for you. And, you know, like, I mean, for myself, I think I haven't taken advantage of the flexibility that I have. So I'm partly like working from home sounds good if I could like take breaks all the time, but having little kids, they don't respect my boundaries.
No, but they go to school, right? Mm-hmm. Your children go to school.
So
when they're at school, you work. So my kids leave 8 o'clock in the morning. So 8:05, I'm at the computer. I'm there till, you know, gone 12. That's solid. That's my time. That's my like core, you know. And it's silent. There's nobody here. But, you know, every hour my computer tells me to stand up. So I go and, you know, hang up the washing, make some bread, you know, have a coffee, whatever. I've got all that time and all that flexibility, but I've got that solid block of, you know, really concentrated work, much more so than I ever had the few times I've worked in an office where everyone's like, oh, you know, let's want a coffee, want to chat. Like, no, I don't want to chat. I want to work. Why? Because I want to stop. Why do I want to work? Because I want to stop working when the, you know, time comes, and I want to go and live my life. I don't want to be stuck here till 10 o'clock at night because I messed around the water.
You don't want to play StarCraft after work?
No.
Right,
no,
Carl,
I don't want to.
We're just going to start.
I want to spend time with my family.
We're starting an old angry engineers podcast.
It's not angry. Right, it's just wisdom.
No, but this is the thing, right? You talked about the industry and the way we employ people and the way it kills people. But like, we have this culture where they have, you know, your remote work's not allowed. You have to come into this office, and this office is like a, I want to say a boiler room of stress and, you know, and your commitment. And they're like, you know, why don't you socialize with your work people after work? No. Why don't you go home and socialize with your friends and family? And then when you come to work, you can be at work. Mm-hmm. Like, why don't we have that healthy separation?
Well, yeah, I'm curious as a manager what you think. I mean, my observation is that from a distance, code is as close as you'll get to being able to tell what work is because you can just read the commits. But it's still the case that attitude and butt in seat is the easiest proxy for hard worker, even with code. Because if you're managing a bunch of people, you can't. You're probably not doing code reviews of all their code, so it's just hard to manage people. I think it's hard to know what someone's actually doing, even with code, from my experience.
I mean,
I don't know what your thoughts are.
I don't really feel like code is the work of programming. Code is the artifact of programming. The work of programming is thinking. That doesn't require my butt to be in any particular place. It just requires me to think. Because, I mean, like, that's programming is problem solving, right? Like, that's all it is. It's literally, I have these inputs, and I need to make that output. How do I do that? And I connect dots in the middle somewhere, right? So, programming is thinking. Programming isn't writing code. Programming isn't drawing UML diagrams or anything like that. Programming is thinking, right? Maybe it's notes on paper. Maybe you write down your notes in a text editor. Maybe you blather to a friend as a rubber duck, whatever. You think. And eventually you create some sort of artifact, which is probably code, but may or may not be. Maybe it's a Google Doc, maybe it's a README, maybe it's an API blueprint, I don't know, whatever. So, like, I don't feel like butts need to be in seats for that. I feel like if there's any job that can be 100% remote, it is definitely programming, because it requires nothing. It requires an internet connection and a laptop. That's basically it, right?
Well, maybe we'll talk about this in a year or two. I mean, just from my experience, even managing a small team of a half dozen people, even then it is hard to separate the work from, you know, these more intrinsic indicators, I would say.
I think a lot of it comes down to culture of the companies, because like, O'Reilly's been pretty good about this. Treehouse was really good about this of, if you're going to be a remote company, it's remote first. Everything is done remote. There are no in-office meetings that don't include a video call of some kind. no notes get taken anywhere but like Google Docs, right? Conversations happen on Slack, and you pay for Slack so that history persists. Those kinds of things, you do everything remote, you do everything async, and that way you've built up this trust in your employees and them in like their managers or just management in general, that everything is in the open. They can see what's going on. They may not have, you know, the latest budget numbers, but they understand that this decision got made, and here's what was made, and here were the arguments and the questions before, and this is what we're going to do, because there's a link to this library, or there's a Google Doc about it, or the code's been written, and they just have to look at a PR. So I think that adds a whole lot to the business working well with remote.
Yeah, I think it's hard to not be remote first.
I've known several places that tacked on remote, and they all just, it was horrible at every one of them.
No, it never works.
Yeah,
it never works. So as a teacher, how do you what would you recommend to someone who's new to web development or Django? What kind of approach would you recommend, given that you've taught and you mentor people now? Like, where to start?
Yeah,
so
I think it depends.
I'll tee one up. So how much Python do you need before you dive into Django?
You should have you should be comfortable with like importing. You should be able to understand how imports work, where the thing is coming from. I think you should be comfortable with classes, at least that they exist, and like the difference between different kinds of attributes and methods. Not as much now. I used to say you need to be able to read regex, even if you can't write them. But with the path stuff that we have now for URLs, it's much less of a problem. And other than that, so long as you know what like the different basic data types are and functions are, like you kind of don't really need anything else for Django. Django is large. But Django is fairly simple once you get under the hood, and it's just Python. There's nothing, now that admin has been made fairly sane Python, there's nothing magical inside Django anymore. Admin for a long time was the one last magical spot, but I think most of that's gone now, right, Carlton?
It's still, you know, it's amazingly powerful. And so because it's powerful, it takes quite a lot of effort to work through. But, you know, if you're just using the admin, I mean, you know, there's a difference between the surface area where you have to go and look up the options versus digging inside it.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't think you have to know a huge amount of Python for Django. I think you can start off pretty simple. I think the one learning thing I have that's weird to a lot of people is I don't think Python or whatever should be the first language you learn. I think the first programming language you learn should be SQL, because we are used to SQL, right? You go to a restaurant and you order something off a menu and you tell the waiter what to bring you, which is exactly how SQL works, as opposed to programming languages where you tell the waiter how to make your meal.
Right.
SQL, you just say, I want this thing, give it to me, and the waiter brings
it. But also as well, with that's a great suggestion, actually, because with the Django ORM, like the basic filters, you can get those without SQL. But then there's more expression, more newer features that have come on, like window functions and the expressions API. And the kind, if you know how they map down to the underlying SQL, which if you learn SQL from a newish book, you will learn all that stuff, then it makes much more sense. Yep. And then you can really get the power out of the ORM. You know, the ORM is super sophisticated, and lots of people aren't getting the full out of it because they don't know the underlying SQL, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and you can learn the basics of SQL in a day, certainly a week.
A day or two. Yeah. There's a PG exercises thing, which is great.
Yeah. Well, I guess as we go out, what resources do you recommend for learning SQL? Because there's a million books and things, but I don't know if there's that many great ones from my experience.
It has been quite a while since I read SQL, since I learned SQL. Sorry, go on.
I was just going to say there's a site I run is a JavaScript implementation, sqljs.org, so you can play around without having to worry about loading up a database in SQL, which a lot of times that's the biggest hurdle for folks. There's other JavaScript emulators, but I'll link to that in the show notes. But if you just want to, you can import a file and you know, you can do it just in the browser.
There's a super site called PG Exercises, PostgreSQL Exercises.com, pgexercises.com, which talks you through, you know, getting started with Postgres and SQL with Postgres. And so I recommend that. It's good.
Oh, good. I didn't know about that one.
No.
Yeah, I don't know that I have any SQL specific ones, unfortunately. after right, I go, well, this is... you should learn SQL first.
But
I don't know where, don't but know you're how. Just gonna learn it.
Yeah. Well...
there are a lot of, like, if you go look a lot of the like, data science-oriented, like, boot camps or training sites, like Data Camp or Data Quest, things like that, a lot of them often have really good SQL guides as well. Often aimed more at getting data analysis out of SQL than just, like, querying for records. But you'll still learn how to query for records because you have to be able to query to get data out.
Oh, and there was an amazing thing as well, which came up today. So I've got to check this out. But there was a detective story based on a SQLite database. So you have to solve the crime by querying the database. And then Simon Willison's wrapped it up in dataset. So you can browse dataset or use dataset, enter the thing, and you solve the crime. I saw that come through today. We'll put that in the show
that
notes.
Came out
that
yesterday.
Looks amazing. Yeah, that looks amazing. We've got to put
SQL
that in
murder mystery and dataset. Oh yeah, I saw that. Oh, what a fantastic idea.
Yeah, let's put that in the show notes because that looks just awesome.
That is an excellent idea.
Occasionally Simon has a good idea. So.
Occasionally, like about four times a day. Anyway.
Well, Kenneth, thank you so much for taking the time to come on. I think I've learned some stuff. I think it will help others to just hear about what it's like to be an experienced dev, to be a teacher, and working at a place like O'Reilly that seems to get a lot of this stuff right.
Yeah, I am very glad to be here and to share what I can.
Well, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we'll see everyone next time.
Bye-bye.